a teacher pay proposal in the state of the state. House Republicans block a DCS bill amendment. That plus a legislative package aimed at Curtis Hill. And more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 18th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb announced in his State of the State address he wants to free up $140 million for schools over the next 2 years as a way to potentially boost teacher pay. Holcomb's proposal would use money from the state surplus to fully fund a teacher pension fund. Doing so would lower the amount schools have to pay into it, a total savings for districts of $70 million a year. And Holcomb outlined his goal for that money.
I believe local school districts should allocate 100% of the $140 million to increasing teacher paychecks.
Holcomb also used his yearly address to reemphasize the need for a hate crimes law. He says he wants a measure that has a list of victim characteristics that includes sexual orientation and gender identity. House Republican leader Brian Bosma has spoken positively about a different hate crimes approach, one that doesn't include any victim characteristics. Bosma says he doesn't think Holcomb ruled that out.
He stated his preference. I didn't hear a line being drawn or, you know, say my way or the highway. That's not Governor Holcomb's style.
Does Holcomb's teacher pay proposal go far enough? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, all four caucus leaders spoke supportively about this plan. So did the governor hit this right on the mark?
Well, it's obviously an improvement over where he was, but it's not enough. I mean, when you break this down, it means about $1,100 per school teacher for 2 years only. This is a two-year, quote, fix, unquote. I mean, we're still paying them in effective dollars less money than we were 10 years ago, okay? We are not supporting public education in the way we need to. And although this is nice, it is not nearly enough. The idea that there are teachers in this state making less than people with high school diplomas and not even high school diplomas is deplorable. And either we're going to get serious about K through 12 education, which, by the way, everyone who writes about jobs and the need to train the workforce for the next generation says where the money should be invested is K through 12, or we're not. And this is a step in the right direction, but it doesn't designate the money directly for teachers. And when you have school districts that are having trouble paying for health care costs and electricity and all the other things they have to pay for, and then blaming them for not raising teacher salary, it's a little ironic. We need more money.
We come back to the same issue. How can we guarantee that this money will actually go to teachers?
Well, this is a win-win. This is actually kind of a slam dunk in two different ways. One, we have a fully funded pension for teachers that started teaching after 1996 now, which how many states are fully funding their pensions instead of borrowing against them.
Which was a Democratic initiative, by the the way.
Great job. And now we delivered on fully funding it. So this is great.
And then
the governor did what Ann has asked to do many times, which is on priority matters, go to the surplus and free some dollars up to go pay this pension obligation, and it reduces the share that schools then have to pay back to the state as a percentage of that teacher compensation. And so these are ongoing dollars that they can invest in salaries. And from just a procedural, I guess, we have talked a lot about this is a local control decision, and districts need to make the decision. This is as close as you could get to the same pot of money now going into paychecks as opposed to going into to fund the pension obligation.
Yeah, you're saving money that you're paying for teachers.
Right.
So hopefully you're going to spend it.
Right. So you're not affecting any other pot of money. You're just moving it into paychecks instead of pensions.
Does this get things a lot closer to where I think everybody wants them to be?
It certainly moves in that direction. If this were the only Band-Aid for the problem, it would not work, clearly. It would be a non-starter. But the fact that this is something that a few weeks ago nobody actually expected, wasn't in the written budget presentation that we went to to the budget committee, Ways and Means Committee early on. So a bit of a surprise there. And you couple that with the notion that the governor wants to look at the longer-term solution or fix through the creation of this committee task force panel. I'm not sure what the correct...
It's a next-level commission.
Next-level commission.
Be, I should have... Better be running a brand here.
We can study it.
That, of course, is designed, he says, to ensure that we not only get teachers in Indiana caught up, but that we find the right way to fund them on an ongoing basis. So I think... what this does is blunts some of the frustration or animosity that was building on the part of teachers. And I think the other thing he's done that is smart, and Mike can certainly address this more, but it's not as if all of this is unfolding over here and that the State Teachers Association and other organized groups are over there and they're all going to surprise each other. What I think he's doing and doing well is working with them and explaining what his thinking is so that it makes it much more unlikely that we'll see the sorts of job actions that we saw, for instance, in Los Angeles this
week.
Well,
you don't have a statewide. Well, Nikki, I think
this was about as supportive a response from the legislative leaders as you could expect, I think, right?
Yeah, why wouldn't it be? I mean, they have the money in the surplus. It's a direct, you know, kind of correlation. And almost more importantly than unveiling it, I think by using the State of the State as the bully pulpit to stand up there and say, I think 100% of this money needs to go to teacher paychecks is key, because I think who wins the PR battle between the legislature and local boards on this paycheck issue is going to be interesting to watch.
Right. Well, Indiana House Republicans denied an effort by Democrats this week to compel the Department of Child Services to meet legally defined caseload standards.
State law establishes how many cases on average DCS workers should have at one time, and a new bill alters those numbers a bit to help the embattled agency better comply. But a Supreme Court decision says the standards are unenforceable. Democratic Representative Ryan Hatfield's proposed amendment takes guidance from that court decision. Hatfield's proposal would compel DCS to hire more caseworkers if caseload limits aren't met. Republican Representative Dave Frizzell says state oversight commissions are already keeping a close eye on the caseload standards. Republicans defeated Hatfield's amendment along party lines.
Mike O'Brien, why not put some more teeth into state law regarding DCS caseloads?
I think when you're trying to craft these proposals, any proposal in the legislature, and the courts have already said you can't go that far, you try not to go that far and then invite a challenge to that part of the code. So, I mean, they're implementing the standards that Governor Holcomb asked to be developed over the course of the interim while they were trying to figure out and isolate exactly what the problems and exactly what the solutions are for DCS, and they're doing that. And caseloads is a big part of that. There is clearly a lot of... We're in this situation not because of teeth in the law. We're in this situation because there is oversight, there is political pressure, and there's a sense that from Governor Holcomb that this is just the right thing to do. So I think there's ample transparency here and ample pressure to make sure that they stick to the caseloads the way they've been recommended and the way they're going to look in the law.
The way things with DCS have unfolded over the last year, isn't that proof why we don't need what
Democrats
propose? No,
it's exactly proof that it had to unfold after 14 years of Republican rule that we do need the oversight. What the court said was not that they couldn't enforce those standards. What they said is they were not objective enough for them to interpret what the legislature was doing and enforce those standards. This was designed to make them objective so that the courts could enforce it. So when the spotlight is off DCS and the money starts slipping out or it doesn't rise to the occasion the way it needs to do, as it does every time. We've seen this before. We get the peak because there's a crisis. It goes down. Oh, it's down. Oh, we've got to study it. Let's get back up again. Then it goes down again. This is designed to make sure that doesn't happen and that children are protected. And if they were serious about it, this would have been approved, and it would have been approved on a bipartisan basis.
The legislature gives DCS money, though. And so how would this amendment... Do you have any sense of how this amendment would work in terms of DCS can't just start hiring people?
Well, the fact is that DCS is constantly hiring people. So, I mean, there's some argument out there to be made that I'm not even sure how a court would enforce it because DCS would come in and say, you know, because they literally constantly have a class of training going through for new caseworkers. So they're always hiring people. And also they are changing the caseload numbers a little. And I think it might actually become a little moot because I think with the way they're going to gauge families or kids, I think our caseloads are going to drop below the state. level?
There's been, over the course of the summer, I think, and in the interim where this bill that they were trying to amend was largely crafted, I think there was general agreement from both parties that they all worked together, they were all moving in the same direction. With this, do we start to see a divergence where one party is saying this isn't good enough anymore?
I'm not sure it's come to that point. I'm not sure if you look at state code, and I haven't, it's not by my table at bedside, I don't go to bed reading the code, but I'm not sure there are many areas of state government where the legislature has specified these kinds of guidelines like teacher-student ratios, either the K through 12 level or college, or inmates versus correctional officers. I think there's guidance in many cases, but it's left to the agencies to determine how to implement it. I think the General Assembly is reluctant historically to put those kinds of hard caps or those guidelines. Having said that, I do think that what happened over the past year effectively ensures that guidelines will be followed. Because the last thing any politician needs, certainly, now I'm not saying over time, you know, if three governors from now, and this is not an issue, maybe things start to change. But for this governor and this administration and this General Assembly, the notion of not heeding the caps or the guidelines that had been put forth and somehow giving short shrift to the kids in the care of the state of Indiana, and then something happens. And then critics can point to say, well, look, you in a unified fashion, Republican supermajority in the House and Senate shot down these caps, and now you're running roughshod over the well-being of children. No one wants to pay that price.
It'll happen.
Maybe in two or three governors down the line.
It wouldn't even have to be two or three governors. It'll happen.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the General Assembly force DCS to hire more caseworkers if the agency isn't meeting its caseload standards? A yes or B no. Last week's question, should state lawmakers mandate how much local schools have to spend on teacher salaries? 53% say yes, 47% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Democratic state lawmaker has filed a series of bills aimed at Attorney General Curtis Hill, who's accused of inappropriately groping her and three other women.
Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon and three legislative staffers say Curtis Hill groped them at a post-session party last year. A special prosecutor declined to bring criminal charges. Reardon's slate of four bills would address the incident. One establishes a new crime, lewd touching. Another would create an oversight commission that investigates state officials like the Attorney General and could remove them from office. The Munster Democrat says her legislation aims to close loopholes in a system she believes should better protect men and women from sexual harassment in the workplace. Despite earlier calls from Governor Eric Holcomb and others for Hill to step down, Republican legislative leaders have said they won't take any actions this session to remove the Attorney General from office.
Nikki Culley, quite frankly, are these bills going anywhere?
No. I mean, Republicans have moved on from this. It's pretty much a non-factor in the legislature. I do find the lewd touching issue interesting. I remember talking to the special prosecutor in the case after and saying, I mean, I didn't know that it's apparently legal in Indiana to be groped by someone in a bar. As long as they're not rude or angry about it, it's all good.
Well, it's rude, angry, or insolent.
Insolent, too.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Is, of this package, is that the one that theoretically might get a little movement, or is it too tied to Curtis Hill to...
I think it's too tied to Curtis Hill. I think Nikki's exactly right. I think the supermajorities in both chambers want to move on. They're not happy that this gentleman is still in office. They called for his resignation some time back, but I think that's about as far as they want to go. And I think there would be many in the General Assembly, you mentioned the lewd touching specifically. I think some members of the General Assembly, maybe in both parties, let's say, might see that as a recipe for confusion and a never-ending court challenge, simply because we talked about the challenge of defining things a moment ago with something arguably as quote-unquote simple as how many caseworkers does it need to, yeah. Do you need to protect the well-being of children? When you try to discern or define in code what constitutes lewd touching versus not lewd touching,
it's all that hard, John.
Well, but let me ask, so we just heard that it's unlikely that any of these things will move. Is that okay?
Well, I disagree with Nikki. We were running a parallel track prior to the special prosecutor deciding not to bring charges. There was a legal track and a political one, right? And Curtis Hill was had to deal with both of them, and so did Republicans. The criminal activity was foreclosed, right? And so it moved completely to a political process, which Republicans haven't moved on from. We've just moved it to the election. Now, whether Republicans decide to file a candidate to run against Curtis Hill at the convention in the summer of 2020, that all remains to be seen. But in the absence of criminal charges in this case, the only recourse really was political, because the current mechanism doesn't... It's not open and shut that he should be impeached and removed for a lot of people in the absence of a criminal act.
Well,
or at least a criminal process.
We don't have the criminal process, but there's no question that this occurred, okay? And the fact that the highest elected judicial official in the state of Indiana can go and rope somebody.
I agree with the governor. I agree with Republican leaders.
Okay, but they need to do something about it, okay? And they can do something about it. All these bills would have prospective application. And what's wrong with saying in the future people are going to be protected from this clearly, like staff people? The issue is whether they worked for him or not. All right, there are all kinds of legal issues about who he is and what their status is and whether or not there's an employment issue. Okay, we could clear that all up with these bills, so that in the event the Republicans decide to put Mr. Hill in for another term and he decides to go out and do the same kind of reprehensible conduct, there will be a remedy. And it ought to be done. There are supermajorities. All leaders and the governor have called for his resignation, and it's up to them to step up and do something about it. If they don't, what they're saying is, well, it wasn't really very nice, but it's not important enough for us to deal with. And that's unacceptable.
All right, well, former Congressman Luke Messer is heading back to a lobbying firm just 2 weeks after his 6 years in the U.S. House ended.
Faegre Baker Daniels Consulting announced Tuesday that Messer will co-lead its federal advocacy group and advise businesses and others on federal regulatory and policy developments. Messer spent 6 years as the congressman for Indiana's 6th District before he lost the GOP U.S. Senate primary last year. Messer was previously a registered lobbyist in Indiana from 2006 to 2012 before he was elected to Congress.
John Schwanis, just more of the revolving door of politics?
I suppose it is. On its face, it is. The question is, good, bad? If it's bad, how bad? And, I mean, this just is, I don't like to dismiss things as saying this is the way things operate, but to a large extent, this is the way things operate. You look at some races in Indiana, we can go back to, say, U.S. Senate, Evan Bayh and Dan Coats. You had people who both had been in the revolving door for a period of time. Dan Coats, of course, some people thought that would be a disqualifier after he did his first go-round in Congress, in both the House and the Senate, and then his tenure as an ambassador to Germany. He was with King & Spalding, which was another big D.C. firm, which is also populated by a number of other high-profile officials. And then, of course, he came off the bench, so to speak, to go back and run successfully for the Senate. And Evan Bayh, his opponent at one point, was certainly... or another person, I should say, who ran for U.S. Senate, that same seat, same sort of situation. So it really strikes me. And there's one more thing this may be a difference without a distinction. But if you leave your seat to go because some wad of money is being dangled in front of you, and you leave your, what is it now, $172,000 a year congressional salary or whatever it is.
But that's not what happened.
That's not what happened. When you're vying for office and you lose, you can't really begrudge someone the desire to have a livelihood.
Do you think that makes a difference in this particular case? That it wasn't that he left Congress, it's that he got forced out of Congress in a sense.
I do think it makes a difference. But I do think it's also just another example of we have, you know, for whatever reason, whether you're talking Coats or Bayh or, you know, former Congressman Messer, you know, you go out there, their families settle out there, but they still say we're Hoosiers. But then when the opportunity comes around for them to come back to Indiana and, you know, be part of, you know, the culture and the society here, they choose to stay out there.
You pointed out just a little while ago that it wasn't just lobbying firm, Congress lobbying firm. It was actually state legislature
state lobbying to Congress to federal lobbying, which makes me wonder whether the people in his congressional district were aware that what they were doing was increasing his marketability in the private sector once he was defeated or left for whatever reason. It's a problem. I think lobbyists in general with all due respect, have way too much impact on the process and in the state, in the state in particular, because I don't think that the legislature has sufficient staff to do the job, and I think they rely too much on lobbyists for that, and I think that's to the detriment of the rest of us.
Given John talked about how common this is, not certainly just in Indiana, but all over the country, do people even notice this anymore?
They do. I mean, they do because it's talked about. I don't think but I think it feeds a perception that may not exist. I understand what Ann said, that lobbyists appear to have too much influence. We run up, and I'm a lobbyist in the state. I don't do any federal work, but we run up against constantly constituent opinions and interests back home and things that we have to try to work through, and appropriately so, that legislators, what's happening back home and how this is going to play back home is still top of mind. And maybe that's because of the proximity of a state legislator to their district, and they know they're going to be back there Thursday afternoon. They're only, they're there more than they're here.
Sure.
And that's important. But,
you have to admit,
We're also, as obvious and former elected officials, not really good at anything else other than navigating complex legislative processes.
Don't put that on your
So some lobbyist groups have a disproportionate amount of power. The NRA, for example, in this state has a way disproportionate amount of power. And you've got people in this state that think that sensible gun regulation is long overdue, and yet there's not a snowball's chance of having that happen as long as the Republicans
are. Well, that's just the NRA, or is he talking about the how does it play back home?
Well, I think it plays back home. I think it plays back home to have some sensible gun regulation a lot better than it's given credit for,
could it be
and they don't care.
As who's interested in the process and who's knowledgeable of governance. If you run a lobbying firm and you have a job opening, I mean, most places you want to get people who know what's going on and have an interest. The last thing anybody wants to do is go somewhere. I've never had any experience in politics. I hate politics. You're a perfect person for the job. Let's come and be a lobbyist.
I entered the revolving door going backwards. I started as a lobbyist. It was my first job, and then I went into government.
And see, from your highest
paid campaigns.
So you made your credentials better.
Yes.
Second Lady Karen Pence, Vice President Mike Pence's wife, began teaching this week at a Virginia school that bans gay students and kids who have gay parents.
According to the parent admissions policy on its website, Emmanuel Christian School can refuse to admit a student or force them to leave if the, quote, atmosphere or conduct within a particular home, the activities of a parent or guardian, or the activities of the student are counter to or in opposition to the biblical lifestyle the school teaches. This includes participating in, supporting, or condoning sexual immorality, homosexual activity, or bisexual activity, or promoting such practices. Staff at the school are subject to similar restrictions. A spokesperson for Mrs. Pence's office told the Indy Star it was, quote, absurd that the school's religious beliefs have come under attack. Mrs. Pence's office says she'll teach twice a week until May.
Michael Bryan, how much does this matter?
I think it matters a lot, but not in the sense that you might expect. The lines in the two camps on these issues are well established, right? But the problem, one of the problems I have as a, and I've been an LGBT advocate at the State House on many issues, and including the current one on hate crimes. This was a story of a Christian woman going to a Christian school to teach art, and it became a referendum on, should religious institutions be able to discriminate for this purpose. And I get it, but it's not helpful from an advocacy standpoint to constantly be this combative about things that it had nothing to do with. This wasn't the stated reason to go there. It was Karen Pence wanting to go teach art, and that's it. And it's become this incredibly toxic conversation about what I understand and agree with are policies that need to be revisited.
There are issues at the State House, not just on bias crimes, but something that's very similar to this with a local school in Indianapolis. Does this conversation about Karen Pence specifically working at the school help or hurt?
I think it helps. And the reason I think so is this isn't about her religious freedom. She and the members of that church can believe any ideas they want. They can hate homosexuals, which they probably do. They can think it's evil. They can do all of that within the confines of the church. But we're not just talking about Karen Pence. We're talking about the Second Lady of the United States of America. And we had Mike Pence, when he was governor and all of the RFRA stuff that he did, stand up in front of the camera and say that he wouldn't go to a restaurant that discriminated. Okay, well, his wife is going to take a paycheck from an institution that discriminates against children. And I think that is newsworthy. I think that's a poor example of her judgment, and it shouldn't happen. Sure, she should be able to teach. Sure, she should be able to have a job. But she represents this country, okay? And to say that that kind of thing is okay for the Second Lady is wrong.
And that's, it wasn't a statement on that part of it. This was,
but she is taking a check from an institution that discriminates against children.
Well, some may.
It wasn't. I'm sure that's not why she went
there.
She
may not.
But
have done
as a result, I think
in the LGBT community, and I'm not, and I'm speaking obviously for me here. It makes the debate at the State House a lot harder when we swing at every single pitch and try to marginalize every single person.
This is
that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.